Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts, Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investors Council of Australia and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisors of the Year.
All right, folks. You're on the Property Couch for each week. Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property investing, finance, and money management. Happy New Year, mate. Happy New Year. Ibis as well with a clap, oh, mate. 2018.
Happy New Year, mate. Happy New Year.
Mate, how good was it to bring in the new year?
Oh, terrific.
Terrific.
Absolutely terrific.
We had an awesome 2017, but we are going to have an even better 2018. I can just feel it,
man. Are you saying bigger and
bigger
better?
Bigger and better.
Oh, Ibis,
I know you're looking nervous, but the couch is going to be big in 2018.
Bigger game this year, Bryce. A bigger game. Yeah. Bigger guests. Exactly. More high-profile guests. What else are we going to do?
Mate, we're just going to bring more knowledge to the people of the Property Couch community. No well-worn tracks
here,
mate.
Don't stop me, Bryce. Don't stop. You're beauty!
Yeah, folks, we hope you had a great sort of Christmas and festive season and brought in the new year, Ben. So let's bring it.
Bring it. Now, some people might still be on holidays, Bryce, too.
Yeah.
So chill out.
Yeah.
You know, but we're excited.
We are. Mate, they could be at a campground, they could be on a boat, they could be overseas.
Tell us who you want on this year. We'll go and get them.
Yeah.
We will find them, we'll get them, we will tweet them, we will go ask for whomever. We want the biggest and the best guests this year.
We have got an awesome lineup planned for 2018, Ben, but we're always, just before we hit print on the itinerary, we want to make sure that we've covered everyone, so let us know. We'll put it up on Facebook, Ibis. We'll get a conversation started about, just to make sure we've covered off everything. All right, my mindset minute today, Ben, is...
to start a new year, no pressure on you,
mate. You'll like this one, Ben. You'll like this one.
And I'm glad you're doing it, by the way. I think it's important that you do the mindset minute.
All right, so I'm going to do the mindset minute. So today, the number one tip, Ben, so with your New Year's resolutions, people at this time of the year, they're writing their goals for the year.
They are.
I've done mine. I've thought about this. Don't worry about that. I'm having a big year this year,
ooh,
Kingsley.
Ooh.
So, but my number one tip for people who are writing their goals, Ben, is don't start from zero. So when you're setting your goals for 2018, start by listing the accomplishments from the previous year.
Love it. What a smashing idea.
Because here's the reason. The brain accelerates towards the goals the closer it perceives success, Ben.
Mm.
So you think about a marathon runner who's, you know, in that last 5Ks, all of a sudden starts to speed up because they can visualize it. So starting your resolution list with a blank piece of paper means that you absolutely lose the advantage of that success accelerant.
Yes.
So, and this can actually be applied in daily life, Ben. You can actually start the day by reflecting on the successes you had, even the small ones.
I like it.
I'm sometimes good at that, and sometimes I've still got some work to do on the daily one.
Yeah.
But I can assure you that I celebrated the wonderful achievements of 2017 while I was writing my goals for 2018. So there you go, folks. Mindset Minute theme for today.
Mate, I love it. What
number
a great
one tip,
way
don't
to start
from
you.
Zero.
Don't start from zero. Get started. Get into it.
Hey, speaking of getting into it, we're going to give our listeners foundational principles from previous episodes.
Summer series. Foundational principles.
Listen to some of the gold we're going to deliver today from Peter Koulizos, the property professor. Carolyn Wright, property manager extraordinaire. Steve Waters, who's just doing this stuff in the field all day, every day. We've got Paul Baker, who's going to give us some tips around building inspections. And, of course, Chris Gray, the number one hedonist in all of Australia, who loves to build a property portfolio and have a lot of fun. We are going to showcase today some of the best gold from their interviews, Ben.
Let's get into it, mate. I want to listen again. I want to reboot.
Okay. Let's
get
kick
started.
It off.
Gentrification happens all over the world, by the way, because the research that I'm doing at the moment, I'm using literature from all over the world, in particular Western countries like the US and the UK, but it's the same thing. It's old rundown areas close to the city and in some places close to the water. The gentry, that's where the word gentrification comes from, so richer people move in, generally because their work is nearby in the CBD, and generally if you work in the CBD, You're a white collar worker. You earn more money than the people that used to live there, or blue collar workers. So people are willing to spend money to fix up the properties. Property value goes up. Property rents go up. So it's a great opportunity. If you can do your research properly and you can buy into an area that you think is gentrifying, you can make some very good money.
And it happens in the biggest cities in the world.
Yeah.
20 years ago, there was areas around the Brooklyn Bridge and area like Soho, mm-hmm. which were old, vacant warehouses that were used by the homeless. And then you start to see these sort of modern, hip youngsters who are making their way in New York in fashion, art, and those types of things, create that environment. And then all of a sudden it becomes groovy. And then the money comes from the developers. They build that infrastructure. So whoever got in and were watching those new shops and craft shops and where it was happening from a fashion point of view, that's one of the great ones in terms of gentrification in big cities. And we know that that happens in great areas of London and those types of things as well. So we're no different. You know, westernised civilisations, we're status driven. You know, so this is that human interest, human behaviour stuff that we've talked about, where it's about following that lead. And so young architects trying to make their way, trying to get an old sort of blank canvas and trying to do that type of work does make those areas groovy.
Yeah, the creative class is certainly an indicator of gentrification.
Creative class, I like that statement. Have you got a license on that one? Have you traded?
No, somebody else has used that.
The bohemian lifestyle. But so besides that creative culture, is there any other key signs you look for early?
Yep. Look for areas where people are willing to spend their money to fix up the properties.
Mm-hmm.
So I've talked about location, which is close to the city or the sea for gentrification, but also it needs to have historical homes. In Victoria, you call them period homes. In South Australia, we call them character homes. Basically, homes built before World War II. And this is the same in the US and in the UK. Well, the UK, they go centuries back.
Yeah, that's why I asked about Brisbane, because they don't necessarily have that.
No, but the key about West End was its proximity to the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in Brisbane, they have their Queensland.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does Redcliffe have? That's because it's still a bit further out. Yeah.
So
Sandgate has some...
Sandgate and Shorncliffe.
I do like going out to Sandgate. It's a great little pocket. I mean, the fact that you've got to go that final bit to Redcliffe, I actually like Sandgate because it's on the rail line and it's, you know, it's one of those sleepers.
It's
been a sleeper for 5 years. Well, I think people have found it, though.
Sandgate is in my book, just as many of the suburbs on the Redcliffe Peninsula. But the other, if we fast track a number of decades, there's a new rail link going on to that Redcliffe
Peninsula.
So that'll also help as well.
Yeah. But that's been coming for 25 years. You know, that's what the real estate agents 25 years ago were saying. There's going to be a rail line.
Yeah.
You know, they did eventually fix the bridge.
Yeah, they did.
Put a second bridge in. Yeah. That helped.
Yeah. But historical homes are also the key. So if you can find pockets close to your CBD that have historical homes that may look a bit run down now, but you see small BMWs, small Audis, so the aspirational class moving in, that's a good sign. If you see the large Mercs and the large Audis, that's too late.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's already gone up. But if you see the aspirational class there, and they're the ones that are at the local grungy cafe on the Saturday or Sunday morning, not reading the Fin Review, but generally on their phones, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever young people are doing. Whatever the hipsters are doing these days.
With the bugaboo prams, the really expensive prams, right. To go with the really expensive aspirational car. Oh, very good. I guess when you researched the book, you said that you physically walked into every single suburb. So you've talked about for lease and for sale signs in the shopping centre. You've talked about gentrification. What else are you looking for when you're walking into these suburbs?
Ideally, house proud, which generally means a high proportion of owner occupiers mm-hmm. rather than renters. However, in an area with a high amount of flats and units and apartments, generally you find a lot more that are rented that are owned by people that live in them. So a lot of it is correlated with the type of product in the suburb. So if you have a lot of detached housing, it tends to be owner occupied anyway.
So there's some examples of that, Peter, is Elwood in Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
whereas traditionally Elwood's blue chip country. When you do the study on it, something like 65% of people are renting in that because of the density of that. The other classics are Bondi in Sydney. Yep. So you see almost 70% of all stock in Sydney and Bondi is rental property, but that's because the cluster of it is obviously apartments. So they would be exceptions to the rule, whereas as you're talking about before, when you get that 70-30, which is traditional mix, that's what you're looking for in these new areas that haven't had that I suppose, stock arrive, that big development going through, the big subdivisions and that medium and high density stuff arrive yet.
Yeah. So this is the sort of stuff that I've talked about so far is generally market-driven or consumer-driven, but there are other indicators, so where the public money is being spent. So is the state government putting in new infrastructure in the area? Is the local government beautifying the main retail strip? If it's on the coast, are they beautifying the esplanade? Is state or federal government putting in money with major road or rail infrastructure or a new hospital or a university? All of these things, or many of these things, will attract more people. So the more demand in an area, generally property prices and property rents will go up. So it's where is your private, where's the private money going? So not just people fixing up their houses, but your developer splitting a block into 2 or 3 or 4 or 10. So they're confident. Where are the supermarkets being renovated and extended? So, you know, the Coles and the Woolies of this world or the IGAs have done their research to work out, yes, we need to invest our money here because the population is growing or the incomes of the people that are here are growing. So this is a good spot to do our investment. So there are a lot of little indicators that you can look at. And not all the boxes have to be ticked. Like I was saying to Ben before, the creative class is one indicator, but it doesn't mean you need the creative class to go in there before gentrification occurs.
Yeah.
It might happen for other reasons. But there's lots of little indicators that you can look for.
What about obvious signs? When you walk into an area or suburb, there's obvious stuff that puts you off, you know, teens congregating. Are there any non-obvious things that the untrained eye wouldn't notice as you walk through a suburb that maybe we can get some
insights? Look, if you're driving through a suburb, you may not notice.
You get shot at.
That'll work. Driving the windows up. You may not notice the smells in the area or the sounds. So I like to walk through suburbs, or if I can get a bike, I'll ride through a suburb. So what sounds are you hearing? Is it AC/DC up really loud, or is it more modern music? Is it some international music, some Chinese music, some Indian music? Gives you an idea of the people living there. The smells, is there a burnt metal smell, or is there a wastewater plant nearby?
Or a dog cannery that's cooking up all the pal dog food that just wafts over the suburb.
That's right.
My sister lives in Spearwood over in Perth, and they had the small goods factory nearby. Yeah. And it was, you know, the Fremantle doctor comes in at the wrong time and you would get smashed by the smell of that. That's no longer an issue. But that's the type of thing you're talking about.
Yeah. And also the stuff that's not obvious is the stats. You know, I'm a big fan of ABS stats, and I look at things like, is the income in this area rising faster than the state or national average?
Beautiful.
Is the percentage of professionals in the area increasing faster than the state or national average? And professionals, like the increase in professionals, is a worldwide indicator. But I'm not saying that I've made a major discovery, but I'll know more in a month's time. It seems to me the percentage of female professionals are having a much bigger impact than just professionals. So I'll know more in a month's time once my paper is finished.
Roll those correlations and regression analysis to speak. Get that regression analysis happening. You might be onto something there.
Yeah, so that's looking really good.
Here on the property couch.
The other one is an ABS stat is usual place of residence, which basically means how many people are here now that were not here 5 years ago. And in gentrifying areas, that is relatively high compared to the state or national average. So these are little things that you can do. Again, more boxes that you can tick that say maybe this area is gentrifying. So proximity to the city or the sea, historical homes, look at the demographics, and a lot of that will be ABS stats, but also observation, like you said. You know, if I'm walking down the street on a Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock, is it teenagers walking the streets, or is it mums pushing those expensive prams or young women in their gym gear going for a run or for a walk? That gives you an idea of the sort of people that live in an area.
And Pete, is there any time frame you give these areas? Are you of the view that it's you know, give it 2 years, give it 3 years, or are you trying to refine that to, no, I'm on it now, and it's going to happen over the course of the next couple of years? Like there's some examples where you buy in and 5 years and then it happens, as opposed to, you know, trying to get in now. Have you got any views on that?
Gentrification takes decades.
Yep.
So it's not like if you don't get in this year, it's not like it's a hot spot and it's only going to be a hot spot for this month or this year.
Yep.
And it's very hard. I mean, the risk is trying to pick areas before they gentrify.
Yep.
Because they may not gentrify. Just because an area, like one of the other indicators I look at is the not just the median price, lower than surrounding suburbs, but house for house. So if I find a bungalow in this cheaper suburb, is a bungalow in the more expensive suburb, is that more expensive rather than just median price? Because median price can be distorted by new products coming on, by limited number of property selling. So one thing I look at is the median price of properties to give me an indication as to whether this area might gentrify. But if the price is really low because it's a dog cannery or there's a oil refinery.
Or flight path.
Yeah, yep. It's probably always going to stay low. Mm,
yep.
So you need to stay away from there. But where you see in what used to be industrial areas, let's say Richmond in Melbourne, and now industry is moving out because the land is worth more as residential land rather than as commercial land.
Yeah.
That's what you want to look for, or where warehouses are being converted. And there's a great example of those in, say, Collingwood and Abbotsford, where they had warehouses, or they've got warehouses where they used to produce clothes, and now they're apartments.
Yep.
So lots of different things to look for.
Mate, how much gold is in that little section?
Oh, unbelievable, isn't it? Where do you start? Character homes, basically, you know, inspiring class of the hipsters and, you know, those types of people. What are they reading?
How's the little tip about looking for the entry-level European cars?
Yeah.
Rather than the established European cars and gentrification taking, you know, 10 years, but also just gentry. Just to remind myself that the gentry was about the wealthy people, and the gentrification was where gentrification come from.
Income's professional, so a measure of that compared to the average in the area. So good ABS data, good old-fashioned research, Bryce.
Yeah,
good old-fashioned research.
Super thank you for the property professor for coming on the couch and delivering a bit of gold. So hopefully you enjoyed revisiting that. Ben, we thought we'd get our good friend Carolyn Wright on next.
Yes.
And she's a wonderful property manager here in the Bayside of Melbourne. So stay tuned for a few little pearl of tips from her as well.
Bring on Carolyn.
Seeing as you've been investing for so long and you've seen a fair bit, and obviously you see it from the tenant side with your property management business, which we'll talk about shortly.
Yes.
What's your advice to Carolyn back when you were 24, or I guess the first time investor, now that you've been through that process, what did you do that you wouldn't do again, and what would you get first-time investors to focus on now?
Look, I definitely hold everything now and do better research on the areas that I bought in. I'd probably be a little bit more inclined to go outside of my home territory and invest, you know, where you know the research has been done, where the properties are good. So I have kind of wanted to be near my properties, drive past them, touch them, hold them.
Haven't got to that borderless investor stage yet.
Exactly. I'm there now. And look, I do encourage people, you know, as much as I want everyone to buy in Bayside, I think buying where the investments are good is really critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And question without notice, guys, of the process, or what's the biggest mistake you think people do in regards to cutting corners on their process? So do you have an idea of what's the biggest corner that most people cut when they're investing?
In the buying process?
Yeah, yeah, just in the selection processes.
I think that a lot of people don't do their research and know what the market that they're buying into is looking for. So I'm actually surprised that more people don't contact people like us, property managers, and say, hey, I'm looking at investing in your area. Tell me about where are good streets, what are good pockets. We very rarely get those calls. You know, what's the demand? Do you get people that want three bedrooms, two bathrooms? Are they families? So that surprises me that people spend so much money on an investment property without really knowing what the market who's going to really want that property. Yeah.
I think that's a really great point, because I was going to say one of the greatest resources for anyone who's looking to do some research is a property manager. But I always think for a lot of people, a lot of their headspace is taken up with the mindset of will I or won't I? I don't want to get into debt. My friend said I shouldn't.
Yep.
And so much space is given to the question of will I or won't I? And when it actually gets to the implementation, it's like, oh, I just want to get this thing done.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that last week I was looking at a property in Essendon, mm-hmm. investment grade suburb. It was near the it was near the train line. It was near all of Puckle Street and Mooney Ponds nearby. And so what I did is I rang the property manager and I said, look, everything's stacking up, but something's just niggling me a little bit. And we went through the details and I said, look, it doesn't have off-street parking, but mm-hmm. there's parking on the street. And she goes, people in Essendon want off-street parking. Don't get that wrong.
Yes.
And it's like, bingo, thank you. That was that little gem that I just quickly needed to fine-tune to help me make a decision on whether that property, because everything else stacked up really nicely. And I think that's the little insights that the property manager can have. Don't go in that street because I know there's a methamphetamine lab two houses down, or I just know, the intricacies of the day in, day out of people within the suburb.
The micro markets, yes, definitely.
What's the dialogue that you have around landlords when they come to you and they want to have a chat about fees versus service? What's your
feedback? You're absolutely right, Bryce. I mean, often the cheapest agent is in the long term the most expensive, because they're not they're either inexperienced, not qualified, they don't follow a process. So that can be frustrating, because very often it's the difference between a cheap agent and a more expensive one. Is you're talking a few cups of coffee a week. It's not a lot of money in the whole scheme of things.
I remember having that conversation with a client. He goes, I don't know whether to go with, the recommendation you've got suggested to me is on the high side. I can get 1.5% cheaper if I go with this other guy. And I said, have you actually taken the time to think about how much that actually is dollar-wise? He said, no, we worked it out and it was not significant. I said, so if that agent, because I think your point there, the cheapest agent can be the most expensive mm-hmm. is gold, because I think that's absolutely true. Yes. So that's what I tend to drive home to the client. It's about ring the agent, see how long it takes for them to call you back.
Exactly. But walk in a tenant's shoes for a day. That's what I say to most owners. They just don't ever do that homework. For a tenant to call on a Monday to see a property and to have a property manager say, look, it's open for 15 minutes this coming Saturday, that owner has just lost a week's rent. The tenant could be moving in on Saturday.
Correct.
If they were there on the ground to show that property to a qualified person today.
It's your biggest investment asset usually.
Yes.
And yet we worry about mm-hmm. small amounts of fees. Yes. So I have two bugbears. In terms of people who self-manage their own properties, just what are you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tenants, you get a tenant who knows the game
mm-hmm.
and you try and evict that tenant, you will be ruining the day that you decided to self-manage. They get in there and they want this fixed and that fixed and they know how to play the game. You haven't vetted them properly. I mean, for me, a great property manager is actually a human resources manager. They go in and they assess straight away the types of people that they're talking about or talking to.
Yes.
They're interviewing them as they're taking the application from them. They're doing all the vetting because, look, they're on their best behaviour when they're meeting to try and, rent the property. So a great property manager needs to have that unbelievable understanding of who that person is and the quality of that person behind this facade that they're putting on.
I think the property manager shields you from the one percenters, because we've got one of our team here, Matt. He talks about when he was in the IT space, if someone rang him for a computer fault, he'd purposely ring them back 15 minutes later. Because he thought as soon as they hang up, they'll get frustrated and they work it out themselves. So he rings them 15 minutes later and say, I'm just calling you back. And they go, oh, no, I've sorted it out. It's all cool. And he's going, okay, no problem, hang it up. And I think a property manager can do a little bit of that, because if you've got that direct connection with the owner and a little 1%, let's jump on the phone to you, and it could
definitely
be Saturday afternoon, could be Sunday morning. Whereas if you've got the property manager who acts as the buffer, and you guys have boundaries around when, you can't be called at 2 a.m. in the morning, you can't be called at 11 o'clock at night, or you probably can because you're a workaholic, but it provides that little bit of buffer for the 1%ers so that the real issues get addressed. But those little niggly ones, they just sort themselves out. Yeah, if I can speak. Thank you for finishing my sentence. So what's your feedback on that?
About
just having that property manager as the buffer.
Without a doubt. I mean, just even the management of landlords and tenants is so crucial during that whole tenancy period. And everything too, like down to the documentation. You know, if you're downloading a lease from the internet, you know, we have leases that are watertight. They've been written by people that make sure that we're protecting a landlord's best interest. So there's so many little factors. And like you said, Ben, regarding just even getting to know a tenant during that process. You know, there's one agent that'll greet people at the door, take their name and number, and that's it. There's no interest or conversation with them and getting to know their story. And getting to know their story is a crucial part of that process of putting a tenant into a property.
And I'll take it even one step further. One of the biggest things for me, if I want my property let, is the property manager needs to sell the property.
Definitely.
You know, walk them through the property and say, look, this is where the storage is. Pull that down. There's the attic up there. You've got great storage through there. Rather than, would you like an application? Would you like an application? Would you like an application? Do you want me to call you?
Bueller.
Do you want me to call you?
Oh, no, you won't get a call. You won't get a call. I can always guarantee that.
So it just drives me nuts. Yes. So sometimes I have to push back on some property manager and say, get in there and get your best agent in there to sell the property. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to be sold to the tenant, just like, you know, we bought it when we thought it was a good investment.
It's critical. And I think also using that point as well is area knowledge. God, now I can't speak.
Yeah, it's
area
contagious, knowledge, isn't it?
So knowing the area, because being able to new people to a suburb, being able to talk to them about where the schools are, the distance to the shops and some of the amenities of an area, that's also quite critical. Mm. I know I've got one of my girls showing a property in Bentley East today and the people have just flown in from Adelaide this morning. So they're new to the area, they're coming to new jobs, they don't know anything. So it is crucial that she's going to point out where the shops are, where the schools are, accessibility to where they're going to be working specifically.
One percenters.
Yes.
It's a concierge service. You're actually providing them with knowledge of how to fit in, how to feel comfortable in the suburb.
Yes.
And that's going to grow a great way for them to say, whatever properties you've got,
yes,
I want to look at.
Yes.
Because I actually want you to be my property manager.
Definitely. And we will often work with people that we've found or come across that have applied for a property and maybe that property didn't suit them, but we know that they're going to be an ideal tenant. So if we can, we'll really try and push to get them into another property. But, you know, just a little story. We had a tenant that applied for a property in Hampton, I think it was probably about 18 months ago, and we went as far as getting that mum to speak to another local mum about the local school because she was nervous about, you know, which school to choose, and this home was near Hampton Primary. So we found a Hampton Primary mum and said, chat to her.
Oh, and you that can, is brilliant.
Yes, and that sealed the deal. We really wanted to rent that property and they were ideal tenants, but there was that nervousness around the schools.
There's a new tip, Ben. Look for your property manager to be a nurturer. I mean, that's going the extra mile.
That is great customer service.
Mate, a few... Some more gold there.
Carolyn, she knows her stuff, doesn't she?
What about the fact that it's initially not borderless, now sort of opening up the sphere of where she wants to be?
Yeah. Going to all the fundamental plays. But even on the PM side, like some great tips about if you're going to buy in an area.
Talk to them first.
Because you're going to talk to the selling agent. What do you think they're going to say? Oh, it's a great area. Oh, I need another couple of buyers coming in. The property managers probably aren't going to twig that's... They're just going to say, oh, no, go that street, or watch out for there, or no, I've got so many great people who would rent this property out tomorrow. Can I have an opportunity? Just get to know the area.
Well, it's a gender alignment, isn't it? Because if you've got a sales agent, their agenda is to get the commission, whereas you talk to a property manager, their agenda alignment is to make sure that the management is as smooth as possible. So they're not going to overstate and underperform.
Yep.
They're just going to tell you how it is.
How's the demand in the market? Yeah. Oh, it's a bit soft at the moment. We've got a lot of, you know, not too many people asking for rentals.
Mm.
Oh, that says something to you. So and pay for service, mate.
Yeah.
Pay for service.
How's the quote? Cheapest agent is the most expensive.
Yeah, love
Boom.
It.
Boom. Love that. There so it really is. Good stuff.
Thank you, Carol.
All right. Steve Waters, definitely a friend of the couch.
Oh, big friend.
We enjoy catching up
Very
with Steve.
Very good operator, Steve.
He was one of the early podcasts that we did, Ben.
Yep.
But delivered some gold straight off, which was foundational stuff. So let's have a little listen to some of the gold that Steve shared with the couches, Ben.
Beautiful.
You know, a big mistake. I bought a off-the-plan serviced holiday apartment.
Hey,
oh, wow.
Well, so I don't think they get worse than that.
From a white shoe salesman.
Well, yeah, actually it was in a pretty good suit from Lowe's. I shouldn't say that.
Queensland or
no? It was in the Central Coast of New South Wales.
Okay.
Really good holiday area. Great water. Beautiful water. And we bought it because we were sold the dream.
Yeah.
But I suppose a little bit was we thought that we would go up there every 2 weeks and stay in this apartment. And to this day, I've been there 4 times. stayed there 2 times because I don't want to take my own income away.
In
terms of value, I think I bought it for around about 360 off the plan, I think it was, or 362 or something like that.
Yeah.
On completion, it valued magnificently.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I don't know how, looking back, but today it's worth less than what I paid for it. And it was just a very, very expensive lesson, but I'm glad I did it because it has taught me so much.
What's the message that you say to someone that's in that same situation? Because sadly, that scenario that you've just described is very, very common. And for a lot of people, they only realise that in hindsight. So what do you think, for the benefit of the listeners, what do you think are the key things that you overlooked when you made that decision that if you went back, you wouldn't do again?
First and foremost, I think it was just greed and ego. It was just like, oh, here, I bought another one, sign a contract, park it away, that sort of thing. And it was off the plan, so I didn't have to worry about it for, I think it was 18 months, $1,000 down or whatever it was. But I think it's more to do with the ability of the salesman and how they can pitch it to you. And the numbers. The numbers are highly inflated. The costings to operate of the building are never true. If in particular this unit, I think I've got the world's most expensive teaspoons and forks and knives because I'm just continually paying for new ones.
So it obviously has a manager. Is that one of the big hotel groups? So it's a big hotel group. How many in the complex?
It'd be probably a couple of hundred.
Yep.
Yeah.
And how many different changes of management groups have gone through since you've owned it?
That's a really that's a well-pointed question. I think we're about up to 4.
Oh my God!
Yeah, but I've replaced the but the building has replaced the elevators twice. So there was massive extra costings. When I look at the numbers, for every dollar it generates, 51 cents in the dollar is gone in management and cleaning.
Yeah,
that's not even including strata fees, council rates, or anything like that. It's just crazy.
Hey Ben, that's a good thing too. If you think about the filters that we overlay, investment grade, owner occupier opinion, scarcity, they fail all 3 of those.
Yeah,
and a whole heap more.
But that's an important thing for the listeners to understand that even investment grade in terms of the fact that the owner-occupier appeal just isn't there on those particular properties. Put a for sale sign at the front. It's just another investor who they're calculated looking to buy, and they're unemotional about the decision. So
very much so. And
so now in your philosophy, it's again you're matured in your views, and you're obviously studying the sciences and the types of things that you look for.
Mm-hmm.
Just very broadly, what are some of the sort of things that you're looking for when you're searching areas?
Look, apart from what we all talk about, which is population growth and so on, which are the normal fundamentals, I'm looking for consumer confidence or something that's going to get into the market and generate that consumer confidence. So apart from the population growth, apart from the industry, in combination with the price of money, I think is a really good way to put it. The price of money, consumer confidence and supply and demand, they're the 3 pillars of investing. Everything else is a derivative of it in any way, shape or form. We try to pinpoint a market well before the media does.
Yeah.
And that's really important because the media will break or make a market, and whether it's true or not in terms of what they're talking about is irrelevant. They just have that ability. And a good example of that is probably Sydney 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just self-perpetuating. People are buying because they're buying because other people are buying.
Yeah.
And
FOMO.
The sheep eating the sheep.
Exactly, FOMO. FOMO.
Fear of missing out.
I just think there's going to be some people out there hurting that are purchasing now. That doesn't mean everybody, every suburb. But there will be some pain.
Yeah.
Any real roadkill stories you've seen, obviously from clients that have come to you that have sort of said, can you fix what's happened in the past? Is there anything that sort of stands out to you that that you've seen over and above just the standard buying off the plan?
Roadkill, I like that. That's 2 I've got off you now. Roadkill, look, most of the time it's always around off the plan or potential land development, greenfield sites and what
yep.
have you.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
probably the worst I've had recently is a elderly person. I think they were 55, 60 years of age, and they went to another, in inverted commas, which you can't see, advisor.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they had $100,000. And they wanted to invest it before they retired. Mm. And so what this advisor did suggested them to go far north Queensland and buy a quasi-retirement studio, you know, which was a second hand. And they paid $100,000 for it, cash, so unencumbered. And no word of a lie, that property still produces negative cash flow. No debt, and it still didn't break
even.
Oh,
my God.
And...
That is roadkill.
that's coming from the accountant. So there's no, he's not dressing it up or down or sideways. That's fact. So the rental wasn't there to begin with, and the costs to operate, once again, were nothing near where it should have been or what was forecasted. It was just, and to recommend that type of investment for someone at that stage of their life who perhaps is looking for some, you know, pretty quick growth, maybe before they retire. It's just, it was sad, very sad to see. And when they come to me with a situation like that, there is nothing that we can do other than, you know, look at all the numbers and say, can you get out of this and recoup as much as you possibly can?
Yeah.
And with some good financial advice around it, of course.
Steve Waters, he knows his stuff, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And just has the honesty and transparency about the double whammy, I call it, where it's the off the plan and the service department. So, you know, and almost half of his income, that's before rates and all those things. So,
59 cents, yeah.
Yeah, he shares it all, so that's a good story.
And interestingly, when we pressed him, you know, where have you seen the stuff that hasn't worked? Off the plan and greenfields, mainly off the plan and greenfields. So
that was a
theme that's flowed through all of our 150 plus episodes, Ben, but way back then, episode 42, when we were chatting with Steve, avoid those at your peril.
And as we turn, obviously, we're into this new year now, the media makes or breaks a market.
Mm.
They can. You know, they really can affect sentiment. And we're going to see that this year. We're going to see what's going to happen this year around, you know, this, you know, we're either in boom or bust as far as the media are concerned. So they're going to be all over that. So stay true, hold your will, and you'll be good to go.
As always, Steve, appreciate your insights, and it's good to have a look back at some of the gold they delivered back. That was back in December of 2015.
2015, episode 42.
Episode 42.
Good stuff.
Hey, as we turned the new year, we interviewed Paul Baker regarding building inspections.
Yep.
And this is just insurance that no one should avoid. Oh, so.
It's unbelievable how people try and avoid this.
Let's have a listen to some of this gold.
What are the things that they should be looking for inside that document?
Well, there's a lot, actually. So our standard report covers a whole range of things. And when you do read it, it does feel quite cold and, you know, like...
Matter of fact.
You know, there's a lot of issues with the house. But a lot of the issues in the report are just general maintenance things.
Yep.
So building reports need to conform with Australian standards.
Yep.
So you need to cover off on a lot of things. So a lot of those things that you read in a report are just things that you would fix up in general day-to-day maintenance of a house.
Yep.
The things that you really want to look out for are all the footings and foundations, making sure that things are nice and level and...
straight.
Straight, yep. But cracks in walls are a good indicator of issues with foundations and water damage.
Yeah.
Making sure that, you know, the place has been built correctly in the first place, making sure that, you know, all the members in the roof, for example, are correct, and, you know, that there's no issues up in the roof, because a lot of people... When people go and look at places to buy, they might go to two or three opens and spend 15 minutes at a time in these opens. And there's a lot to think about. You know, you think about whether your furniture fit, is there enough natural light, all the things that you think about when you're wanting to buy a home. And there's not enough detail gone into the actual structure itself. So what we try to do is just take that element out of it, and you can just really concentrate on, you know, whether the home is suitable for you.
Sometimes it's not just big structural issues. Again, question with that notice, you might remember that one we did in Seddon.
Yep.
Single-fronted a couple of weeks before Christmas, and there was asbestos in the roof.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yep, I do.
And part of your recommendation was to get that asbestos out of the roof would just be a monumental operation. And if you don't, children who will be sleeping in those rooms will be breathing or potentially breathing those fibres. I mean, it didn't have to just be stumps or footings. It was just a precautionary tale there as well.
Yeah, well, that's right. So that particular house had been renovated, and they put a false ceiling in, which has covered all the asbestos. But then they'd come along and put ducted heating in and made penetrations in the asbestos in the roof. So the asbestos had been broken and hot air was being blown around. So it was just one of those things where nothing was wrong with the house, but it was just a real safety issue.
What should they look for in terms of an inspector? I mean, because what's the minimum entry level for someone who's doing your job? Is there?
Yeah, so no, the industry is not regulated, so anyone can call themselves a building inspector. But if you are getting an inspection done, you would want to really look at the qualifications of that person doing it. So you want someone that's obviously been in the industry for quite a while as a builder.
So a licensed builder is a good example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Registered builder.
Registered builder, yep.
And what their background is. So, and just talking personally, our background in the building industry are renovations and extensions.
Yep.
So we've spent a lot of time actually rectifying or, you know, fixing up
old homes. Beautifying old properties. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, all the issues that we personally see in the building inspections, we've at one time or another, you know, had to deal with those issues. So
So you've got a good sense of cost in terms of what it costs to replace all that type of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But getting back to Bryce's question, what do you look for? You look for someone that firstly can communicate pretty well. And so if there are issues, you can talk through them and make sure you understand, you know, the process to getting them fixed and, you know, the potential likely costs of getting them fixed. Someone that's, as I said, been in the industry for quite a while and, you know, had some experience dealing with the defects, not just reporting the defects, but knowing how to fix the defects.
And the consistency of their reporting, like, is that something you would ask? I know I would.
Yep.
Again, I don't want war and peace. I want a simple worded report that basically gives me some type of rating or whatever, and obviously that's why we've jumped on using you guys because of that.
So when we got involved in doing property inspections, there is an Australian standard to a report.
Yep.
So it was really important that we covered off on all the things that needed to be done. We try to keep ours quite simple, and we try to use really simple terms. So when you do read ours, there are obviously it's an obligation to report all the defects
Absolutely.
And issues with the house. But we try to follow it up with a phone call straight after the inspection and just sort of verbalise the report with the client just to put them at ease. And then we try to do it soon after the inspection as well, so it's fresh in our minds. And then when the report's sent out, you know, we invite, you know, the clients to call us at any time to, you know, discuss any concerns that they have with the report.
Do you know when you read a report and then, you know, you can't get under the floor, you can't see the ceiling, and you put that sort of in there to say, hey, look, these things weren't seen prior to making this recommendation.
Yeah.
What recommendation can you give to someone who's engaging a builder who can't see those things as to whether or not they should go ahead? Do you sort of give them, hey, look, in my experience, I think this could be a concern that I haven't seen it, or in my experience, I think it should be okay?
Yeah, so getting under the floor is a good one, because a lot of the places, particularly in the inner west in Melbourne, where I do a lot of work, the houses are built on stumps but sit quite close to the ground, so you can't get under a lot of the houses. So you can't actually determine the quality of the bearers and joists and things like that, but there's a lot of telltale signs as you walk through the house above the floor, you know,
A bit
of springing in the floor. You can look at doors in door jams as well. So if you look at the gap across the top of a door, it might be
3 or 4 mil
in one corner, and in the other corner it might be 15 mil, which suggests that the house has moved and they've just planed the door to suit the shape of the door frame. Cracks above windows and doors, and cornice cracking is another one where it suggests there's been some movement. Skirting boards that separate from floorboards is another one. So if you've got gaps, you know, there's a range of telltale signs that suggest that, you know, there's some issues below the floor. So you don't physically need to be under there.
And you just bring it to their attention that those are the signs you've seen.
Yep.
Veronica on the show, she always carries a marble, and I thought she was losing them at first. But mate, she just sits it and she puts it there and she just sees where it rolls, just to get her idea of where, you know, the floors are level on
the pitch. That's a great little idea.
Mm. So the thing is, Ben, you know, we help clients, we make sure that they get a building inspection all the time, but when you hear some of that stuff, it just beggars belief why people don't do that.
Correct. Hundreds of thousands of dollars invested for a small fee to get an indication of there are some problems. What's it going to cost to fix them? Some indicatives there. I mean, for me, building inspections are about yay or nay.
Mm.
They're about yay, it's all good, like we hoped it was, or nay, it's a no. It's... Mm. There's too much problems with the structural integrity of the building, or there's some issues with asbestos or whatever it may be. And obviously, you know, that was a bit of Melbourne stuff, but if we're thinking, you know, of different cities, they've got different problems. You know, some areas of Adelaide might be sandy. So is that a good foundation? Is it a bad foundation?
Queensland.
A fair bit of rising damp happens in Adelaide.
And then the moisture, like, you know, mold is a big problem when you've got, you know, high humidity in the areas of Queensland. So what are you doing about that? And the ongoing maintenance around properties in Queensland, if you've got weatherboard or timber, you're going to have to be on top of that maintenance program.
My tip for anyone who's for someone who's seen a lot of building inspections over the journey, Ben, I always tell the client that we're looking for two things. Categories of major and minor. So the majors are the structure okay and is there any termites? And if the answer is no to those, obviously, one or more of those. But the minor doesn't become anything more than a maintenance list, because people go, well, I've seen people try and crash on minor defects, but you essentially can't. You just need to, you may have a little bit of leverage for negotiation. But ultimately, it's, you know, usually established property, you're buying it as is, but you, at least you know what your maintenance list is going to be once you buy the property and sell on it. But for me, Paul said, what to look out for, someone who communicates well and has good experience. They're two fundamentals for someone looking for a building inspector.
So when you're ringing around to find the best building inspector, obviously, you know, give Paul Baker a call, but compare that to, what do you want? Can't do that one, mate. Flat out. Like to, I see what I can put that in. What are we looking at? I mean, you just know, don't you, when you pick up
the phone. The post-building inspection phone call is critical because they are required in writing to make sure it's, you know, all things are brought to your attention.
Yep.
But it's good just to talk, you know, I talk to Paul all the time.
Yep.
Hey, mate, on balance, what do you reckon? He said, you know, on balance... Just go ahead or no.
All right, mate. Beautiful.
Hey, we in April of 2016, episode 60, we caught up with Chris Gray. This guy, wasn't he amazing for this interview? Because
he'd been busy at the races of the motor variety. Yeah. So he came in after the race. So, you know, not much.
He hadn't had much
rest,
sleep.
No, but
he came in and as soon as we recorded, bang. So have a listen to this, because it's Chris has got wonderful nuggets of insights that you should check out.
So in terms of how do you then talk to your clients about cycles in the market and the fact that, so are you sort of just get in and stay in for the long term, or do you talk about, look, we might be buying at a higher end, but that's okay if we've got a long-term view? You know, it's the long-term trend that we're interested in.
Yes. So look, most of the clients follow exactly what I do.
Yep.
And that's how my whole business started, that I was teaching people. So when I retired from work at 31, everyone said, like, how do you do it? And so I just told them the story. And because I didn't sell anything, I didn't have a job, then they believed what I said, because I had no reason to put them down another path. I've always been, I'm not trying to buy thinking it's going to move up next year or the year after. I'm buying for 30 years.
Yeah.
So now the equation is you buy $1 million two-bedroom now in Sydney. Will it be 2 million at some point in the future, which I believe it will be?
Yeah.
And so I don't care about cycles and the rest of it, because, again, I'm not trying to push the limits, because I think when you start pushing it, that's when people go wrong, because they're taking too much risk.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't happen, you don't get the growth and they're screwed. And so I just think whether it happens this year, next year, the year after, I don't care.
On risk profiling, how would you class yourself as a risk taker? Would you say you're high or moderate to high?
Yeah, this is funny. I mean, I think I'm really conservative.
Yeah.
In my purple Lambo. and so because I'm an accountant, I know my numbers inside out.
Yeah.
I know as long as the property market moves 1% to 3%, I'm going to make money. So at the moment, my portfolio is about 15 million.
Yeah.
It costs me at the moment on current interest rates about minus 100 grand.
Yeah.
So as long as the market moves like 0.6%, I make money.
Yeah.
And even if interest rates, like in my book, I've looked back at it, and the interest rates I work out was 7, 8 and 9%. So people say, oh, interest rates can rise. But I was paying 10% before and I was making money.
Yeah.
So I don't mind. So I just think your rent is roughly about 4.5%. Your net yield will then be, say, 3, 3.5%. Interest rates, call it 7 or 8%, so you're dropping 3 or 4%, which is 2 or 3% after tax. And that's all I think of. As long as you've got the buffer to support it, then that's fine.
And so you use what we call a break-even calculator.
Yeah.
So what we might do is actually put that up on the podcast website, thepropertycouch.com.au, because it's a great little one to sort of build comfort around that. Because as you say, you think you're a conservative, but the reality is
you know, you're doing developments, you're now stepping up the grade of activity that you do.
Yeah, most of it though, I'd say, we say we're more major renovators rather than developers.
Yeah.
So we're not buying sites hoping we're going to get a DA.
Yeah.
We're buying sites that if we do nothing, it's great.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. But you're adding value to them.
But if we can render the block, we can add extra levels, the rest of it, it's all low risk kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing versus a developer that's punting that he's going to get a DA.
Yeah.
What's your message to a first-time investor who doesn't, say, have your appetite for risk, where they don't want to get into a lot of debt? Because, you know, the ATO, the most recent stats we can get says that 73% of all property investors stop at one. And then there's a small minority that do multiple. So, because your philosophy is largely around using debt to service debt. Would that be right?
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say, so say round numbers, say you buy $1 million property. At the moment, that's assuming you borrow 100% of the funds, which obviously a first homeowner can't do, but let's just assume that you can, or 105%. It's going to cost you about 10 grand a year. But I think over time, it'll cost you maybe 20 grand a year with interest rates. So my thought is if you buy a business, you need working capital to fund it for the first few years, the same as with property. So rather than borrow $1 million to borrow $1 million property, I'd say borrow 1.1, because you're going to have 50 grand of cost, 5% for cost, and I say borrow another 50 grand. And now, look, the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you've got equity in another property, or you borrow money from parents, or you put cash in, and the cash has got an opportunity cost.
Yep.
So if you've got that extra 50 grand, you can then self-service for the next 5 years, losing 10 grand a year. I think that's much safer than the person that borrows just $1,050,000 has got no cash, loses their job, and they're screwed.
Yeah.
They have to force to sell a property and rebuy back. It might cost them $100,000 or $200,000. So this is a classic thing where society says to get into debt is bad. But I think if you've borrowed an extra 50 grand and you've got comfort for 5 years that your property self-cash flows, to me, that's not more risk.
Yeah.
And this is the thing where I think I'm conservative. So where I borrow that extra 50, to me, that's conservative, good investing versus the person that scrimps and saves and then has got no cash because they overborrow.
Yeah, we call it buffering. Yeah, so we have a buffer, and that's, so, you know, you don't want to gear yourself too aggressively where if something does go wrong. So what we do is we say, look, here's 5 years, 10 years. As an absolute minimum, we'll do 12 months just to sort of say, right, okay, so you've been made redundant or you've had a job change. So at that point in time, you don't have to panic and you don't have to rush sell, because you're right, you can't go back to the lender and say, oh, I'm in a bit of a pickle. I just need a little bit of cash just to get me through this little bit. You might as well get it up front and keep it there for a rainy day. Hopefully you never have to draw on it. You know, hopefully everything goes well in terms of what the investment strategy plays out.
So that's exactly what I've done now. So I think I'm on stage two of property investing. So my whole idea is I wasn't worried about net equity. I wanted to get up to a certain level, say $10 or $15 million. So my portfolio has just gone up $2.5 million. I've borrowed 80%, so roughly 1.7. And then depending on my property, I've put 50 to 100 grand against every single property to then cash flow the difference for the future.
Yep.
And then I've got a lump sum that I can use for working capital in my business or me personally.
Yep.
So I could have taken that 1.7 and bought another $8 million worth of property and had $23
million. Yep.
But my thought is, look, I have a good life and I enjoy things, but I'd rather have $15 million of property with a massive cash buffer than have $23
million.
Because I've got nothing to prove to people.
Yeah.
And if it rises at 10% a year, sure, at the moment I make $1.5 million versus $2.3 million, but I'm not going to live in a bigger house. I'm not going to have a better car, all that kind of stuff. So it's greed is the thing that can really screw you.
Correct, because it's like a house of cards.
Yeah.
Once you get that sort of type of leverage position, it'll just knock itself over because you're chasing each other's stuff. I mean, we've got a feel for those people who bought out in the mining areas and that type of thing. Classic case in point where they've gone out and spent $450,000 on buying the property, and then the next thing you know, their property's now worth $200,000 and they're in negative equity. Now, we're trying to, you know, they come to us and say, what can you do? Well, if there's no other equity elsewhere, it is a house of cards. If we sell that one, we've got to still pay the bank back the difference. And so, you know, it can destroy strategy. So what I like about what you're doing is you're basically saying that I'm still going to stick to blue chip areas. You know, so you're not going to be aggressive in terms of the areas that you're looking. You're looking at proven locations.
Chris loves his numbers, doesn't he, Bryce? He just absolutely loves his numbers.
Mate, he is a bean counter from way back, so you'd expect him to be good about quote him, knowing his numbers inside out. How's his definition of major renovator versus developer? That's a good little...
Nice bit of gold there.
Yeah.
Doesn't care about the cycle.
No.
Just basically playing the long game.
And greed, quote, greed is what can really screw you. How interesting. He doesn't have anything to prove to anyone. He just wants to, you know, if he gets 1.7 or 2.3, it's not going to make a huge difference to his life. So there's an important lesson, you know, in that accumulation phase early days. But he would prefer to have that working capital, which gives him a buffer on all those properties rather than, you know, he thinks he's got the risk equation better than those who won't take that extra amount for the buffer.
Whereas most people say borrowing more money is a bit more riskier. I mean, as long as his property makes a couple of percent, he's making money. Now, which does remind me of that the break-even calculator that we've got on our
website, which you mentioned on the interview.
You've got to get onto that. If you haven't already got it, it's amazing. So, you know, get on, give us your details. We'll open up the area for the free report information. It's called the break-even calculator. You put your numbers in there, tells you how much the property needs to go up in value for you to break even. And you'll find you'd be quite surprised that it's in the low, low, low percentages that needs to increase before you're breaking even.
Well, there you go. Another one for our summer series, Ben. We covered off the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Carolyn Wright, Steve Waters, Paul Baker, and Chris Gray. I'm sure the listeners will agree. Revisiting that gold was well worth the effort. Wherever you are, enjoying your summer break right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is the stuff. This is the knowledge building time. If you've got some free time, get into this knowledge building phase of, you know, listening to podcasts, get the mindset right, because 2018 is going to
be big. Mate.
Play a big game, everyone.
It's going to be a great year. All right, my life hack is for you, old mate.
Oh, okay.
I've already told you this life hack, but I'm doing it on behalf of the...
Right, is it because there's a little bit of shade over the tool shed, or is it sort of anything...
I don't know, mate. I thought, actually, a good festive. Better put my pen down. She's going to get grumpy. Remember when we were in Sydney and we were interviewing Margaret?
Yep. Yes.
And you were complaining that your iPhone was a bit too big for your little fingers to get to the top of the screen.
Oh, yes. There we go. you're trying to balance it because it's a plus.
With your beautiful little walnut, classic 1960s walnut cover case that
you've got there. I'm going to keep that on there just because I know you think it's old-fashioned.
Well, I just think you're actually not that old. You're still only 46. You don't have to roll around with something that's seen with
nano. My walnut cover. So, like, you know, just a bit... Better than boring black.
So I had to remind you that you just double tap the home screen and it brings your screen down from the top, so you don't have to sort of reach your fingers to the top.
Double tap the button.
Double tap the home button. Or for those people on the X's, I don't know because I haven't got the OS X.
Yeah.
But the home button. So just give it a little double tap. Little.
Oh, I just did and it wanted to delete all my. But I'm in the wrong page. Yeah.
A tap, not a press.
Oh.
Little tap. Little feather tap on it. Double, double.
Oh.
Double, double.
A tap, not a press.
Yes.
That's just like a... That's just opened up the whole iPhone thing to
me. So you could still do it with one hand, mate. Because you do a little...
not a press. Couple of little it's taps. Like a little stroke.
That's an even better description. A couple of strokes.
Couple of strokes.
Quickly.
And it drops down.
And it drops down.
That's good. So it doesn't drop up, it drops it down.
And so therefore you can get to the top of your screen without having to stretch your phone.
Well,
and
it's more about balance and dropping
it. Well, that's what I was worried about because we're walking through North Sydney, there's a few people around, I was worried about you dropping your little walnut case iPhone 7. That's of course for the plus, folks.
Yeah.
So that they can do that. So there you go, there's my little New Year's life hack for people to make sure they don't have to spend too much money. Did you know?
Mate, we're going to talk about... So. I came across this website called Visual Catalysts, and they do these cool infographics around, you know, the world of global finance and so forth and global money and all that. So this is a bit of a stat, and it is from last year, but in October last year, but that's all right. So we're talking about, you know, what sort of global debt we've got. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Global debt, mate, $215 trillion, which globally... is 325% of the global GDP. That's like, so don't panic, everyone, because global real estate is worth $217 trillion.
Oh, so the LBI is just in front.
Just a fraction in front of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
We've talked it before. CoreLogic has the data out around how much, you know, Australian property. I think it's now around 7.3 trillion or thereabouts. And
7.5 trillion, yeah.
Yeah, 7.5 trillion now. And then we've got, you know, stock exchange around 2.4 trillion.
Yep.
So we've got some stats here for global real estate. So of that global real estate of $217 trillion,
yep.
Residential. Residential. It's $162 trillion, representing 75% of all of the global real estate value. Office, retail, commercial, 13%. Rural, agricultural land, 12%. There's a little clue for you in terms of where the money's at.
Just goes to show it's the only investment market in the world not dominated by investors, Ben.
Exactly.
75% are for people that need it for essential need.
That's why we go there. That's why we borrow money against it. Low volatility. Global stock market, $73 trillion. Now, which is the biggest stock market in the world, Bryce?
Oh, you just pulled your piece of paper.
Oh, no, because it was cheating.
Well, the biggest stock market in the world... well, the States seems to be the obvious, yeah?
Yep, that's right, 38%.
Yeah.
What's number two? Now, for your benefit, if you think of Europe as a whole, not the UK, but just Europe, how big is that?
As a percentage or as a number?
Yeah, percentage is good.
What did $72 trillion for the US represent, 38%?
No, so global stock market is $73
trillion. Yeah, but what was the US as
38%.
Percentage? All right, so I reckon Europe would have 29%.
Okay, 11%.
Oops.
Oops. China, 10. Japan, 7. UK, 5. Australia does not even register.
No,
so I think we're less than 1% of the global. We're probably 0.3 or something stupid like that. So anyway, there you go. So we'll get you the link to Visual Capitalist, who have got these little infographics on some fascinating stuff there about, you know, what gold and silver and and California's GDP and all the different companies. I didn't know that.
And for me, just a little sneaky, did you know Picker is fully up and running and we got to get some people to make sure there's a voice? $5.
$5. Put your money in. Let's get the numbers up.
News resolution, Ben. Yep. Number one goal, join Picker.
Join Picker. And if you're a husband and wife team, that's two of you joining Picker. Not just one thinking we can get out of this for $5. That'll be $10. And that'll be good, because where does the money go? Back into education and back into research and insights to put our agenda on the table in terms of protecting our investments and looking after you. So there you go, mate.
And all that money, Ben, it's a not-for-profit. So
it is not-for-profit, Bryce.
There's certainly no one trying to take any gravy home on that.
Run by property investors for property investors.
Love it. All right. Well, there you go, folks. Hopefully you've enjoyed that to kick off your 2018. We certainly believe here on the couch, the three of us, that this is going to be a big year. So we certainly hope that you're listening, thinking it's going to be a massive year for you as well. But Ben, next week we've got part two.
Yeah. Fantastic. Episode 154.
Yeah. It's going to be another wonderful session of nuggets. And let's give them.
Oh, give some.
Do you want to give a little entree?
Well, Jane Slack-Smith.
Yeah.
Damien Collins.
Tick.
Veronica Morgan.
Tick.
Stuart Wines. Andrew Wilson.
Mate, there's some big, big names
big
on that list.
Big names. Dr. Andrew Wilson.
Yes.
Specific.
Exactly. So stick around for next week, folks. Sticky's been working hard on cutting up these interviews.
Yep.
And we are bringing them...
Pure gold.
Into some pure gold.
Pure gold.
Can't be said
any better. Just pure gold.
Until next week.
Well, I thought maybe this year you might do a sign-off. What do you reckon about that idea?
What?
It's like... Because we prep all this. It's like... Okay. All right, just remember, everyone, knowledge is empowering, but only if you act on it.
Too true, too true. Until next week, see you later.